Well, welcome back to Jokerman Podcast once more. I'm Evan.
I'm Ian.
Today,
you can see how often we've done this.
Tonight's not like any other night, you could say. Well, actually, it's like several other nights that we've done. It's a Warren Zevon episode of Jokerman Podcast where we have a guest. But the thing that's special and different is our special and different guest. It's Will Menaker from Chopo Trap House.
Huh! Draw blood!
Yeah. I wish we had one of those keyboards with the where it has that sound.
Zevon sound effects board.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, those shitty Yamaha keyboards have that always in there. And it's like, that's him.
Boys, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And I'm this is the first time someone's invited me on a podcast to talk about Zevon, and I could not be more thrilled to be with you here today to talk, you know, the god. You know, I mean, what else is there to say here?
The king,
the man who's influenced my personality and musical sensibility. It's Warren Zevon in the fall. And if you guys do a Marquis Smith fall podcast, please have me on back. Have me back on for that. But
Evan's encyclopedic knowledge of the fall. So we're going to get there eventually.
Yeah, there's probably a British person who is a friend of the show who probably has dibs on the first one. And then, you know, there's going to be an ample opportunity to cover the rest.
From
of
what I understand,
there's
a few fall records out there.
Yeah,
so I'm sure we can.
I mean, yeah, this is a concept that can run and run, boys.
Exactly. It's the content that keeps churning. Where did you start with Zevon? Well, because you're a lifelong New Yorker, Warren Zevon, authentic Angelino. Where'd it come
Cali
from?
Cali boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'd have to go like my first real experience with Warren Zevon was I was introduced to him probably first time ever through the Martin Scorsese film The Color of Money. If you'll remember the famous Werewolves of London scene in that movie where Tom Cruise just runs the table playing pool, hustling for money.
He's just
one long tracking shot. He's just circling around the table, singing, like, you know, lip syncing to Werewolves of London and like doing his like karate moves with the pool cue. And, you know, like Werewolves of London, you know, that's the song I think like everyone hears on the radio. And it was a song I really liked and I really associate with that movie. That's one of my favorites. And then, like, you know, like most people, it's like the singles, you know, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, Werewolves of London. And then I think it was like, oh, man, I don't know when I was like, I got into the, like, once I unlocked the albums and just started like, hey, I'm going to listen to the album that like Lawyers, Guns, and Money is on, like Excitable Boy. When I got into that, and then I think really like for me, the key is when I heard the song Desperados Under the Eaves.
Ugh.
Like for many people, like I think that's kind of his masterpiece. Like that song, like it's just, I think it's the, I don't know what to say. It's just a song that moves me more than like just about any other piece of art in human history.
Yes.
And then like, and then from there I became like a Zevon completist, and like it just, yeah, like it's just, it to me, like his catalog is just so rich, like from the beginning to the end, and like especially those last couple albums, like the ones where he didn't know he was dying, but like all of the songs on it are about dying.
It's insane. And,
yeah, that was the big one for me. And I just learned that recently, that he didn't actually know when he wrote My Shit's Fucked Up.
Life Will Kill Ya.
Yeah, that's the title of that record too, is Life Will Kill Ya from like 2000. Great record.
And then I remember like there was all the coverage of when he was dying and the sort of like heroic effort to get the Wind, the last album,
yes,
out in time with all of his friends, like, you know, Tom Petty and Billy Bob Thornton and, you know, like all the stars to come out for Zevon and like his last Letterman appearance. And then, like, you know, obviously going to the Letterman catalog of his legendary appearances on the David Letterman show. So Zevon to me is, you know, like I won't be stepping on too many toes of our listeners to this podcast or you gentlemen, but I think is, I mean, shit, like I know you're up there with Lou Reed, but like for me, like Warren Zevon is the greatest like American singer songwriter.
Hell yeah, no arguments there.
There's a case to be made, 100% case to be made. I think that's kind of what we're gonna do today a little bit. I mean, there's a few who like all sit on the same Mount Rushmore of like those guys.
I think what's so great about Zevon is that he still always has felt like, and I mean, this is part of the tragedy of Zevon, is that he never achieved like the like heights of commanding success that he might have deserved to, or
right,
that
not like a John Cale, you know, who
right.
Like,
yeah, no, he's always just had that status of like your favorite musician's favorite musician,
exactly,
your favorite
exactly.
songwriter's favorite songwriter.
Exactly.
Which probably would make him really like frustrated and sad to hear over and over again, like it did to many artists. I mean,
but he's still someone that we can feel protective of, you know, like he still belongs to like just this small select club, as opposed to, you know, the original subject of this podcast, Bob Dylan, has been heard by every living person on the fucking face of the earth, you know. So it's there is just like an element of personal relationship with Warren Zevon.
You know, to me, it's like what separates Zevon from everyone else, or like the reason I revere him so much, or like what is it about his music that it's just, to me, he has like such a literary sensibility as a songwriter, in terms of like just what he can, like the amount he can do with the fewest, like the fewest words, like what he can convey. And just like his overall sensibility of like wounded romantic, of like a wounded humanism that is like, you know, scratch the surface of any cynic. And his lyrics are among the most, the meanest, the most cynical, and like the kind of like most despairing, but at the same time, the most genuinely moving and like romantic and just deeply emotional to me.
All right, let's just wrap it up. That sums up Warren Zevon pretty well.
We're talking Stand in the Fire here, folks. You know, listeners of the program may be aware, Jokerman Podcast, we like to go to the, you know, sort of the nooks and crannies of the discographies, the lesser known records, the underappreciated gems, the diamonds in the rough. Zevon, you know, I would love to talk Zevon, Warren Zevon, Warren Zevon, Excitable Boy, Warren Zevon, but it doesn't really fit with the modus operandi of the show here. That said, Stand in the Fire live album from 1980. Really gives us a greatest hits run of all of your favorite hits, and a little bit more than that. So it's a great way to kind of speed run almost all of the great Zevon classics. Desperados, unfortunately, doesn't make the cut, but virtually everything else does.
I'm so glad we got to do Stand in the Fire, because usually, even among artists that I adore, like the live album is sort of like an also-ran. It's not really like heavy in the rotation, whereas this one is like, I make few exceptions. It's like this and like, I don't know, Sign of the Times by Prince. But like this Warren Zevon live album, it's like you really get the effect of like what a live album can really do. Like, because it's like he gives you such a grand tour of like the first half of his career. And then a couple B-sides that I don't even know, like never even showed up on albums. Like they were little surprises to me. That are
title
all
track
great.
There, yeah.
Yeah, Stand in the Fire. They're all. When I first heard that song, I was like, "Holy shit! There's a Zevon song this good that I've never heard before."
Yep.
But yeah, like just the what he introduces into this, and we can get into it. The stage patter. Oh my god, this album is like, this is like a driving in your car classic. This is like, you know, window down. You're punching the roof of your car. Just, oh man.
Title track, Stand in the Fire, like you were saying, Will, just like an all-time Zevon classic that this is it. Never made a record, never came out on a 7-inch with a studio record. It's just like he nailed it live here at the Roxy in 1980, it should be noted, on the famous Sunset Strip in Hollywood.
Dedicated to Martin Scorsese.
Dedicated to Martin Scorsese, also, yeah, the record. Was Color of Money, that was after this, right? That was like 85, 86, something like that?
Yeah, that was like 85, 86, because, yeah, 1980 Tom Cruise would have still been too young at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, what can you say? Like, the title track, like, name of the album, I'd never, like, I thought I was, like, a Zevon completist. Like, I'd even heard, like, you know, the Preludes album of all of his, like, unreleased stuff before the self-titled debut. But this song comes out, and God, what a starting gun for this album! Like it's just what a fucking rocking like fucking song. This song really gets you into it, and just sets you like, you know, like fires you out of a cannon to start this whole album. Just like sets the tone, and just gets you moving. Like, and it's just like the phrase "Stand in the Fire" as like kind of a metaphor for performing.
Yeah, perfect for a live record.
Yeah, for a live record, like no safety nets, you're standing in the fire, and also just sort of the self-destructive glee of Zevon the man himself, and you know, like this kind of this high wire act that, like, you know, he managed to pull off for so long.
Yes, yeah, the self-destructive glee, a common theme that he returns to again and again, and again and again and again throughout his career, maybe a few times too often. But this is it, like, kind of at its heights. Like the this is the good times. Like, we're going up the roller coaster. We're not on our descent down, which will inevitably come, obviously. But I mean, this, when it sounds great like this, it sounds fucking great. I love how stupid kind of the lyric is also, because he's just repeating "Stand yes. in the fire" again and again.
Stand in the fire. Stand in the fire.
And for someone who has such a, like, innate literary sensibility, this kind of, like, dumb guy, dumbed down approach to it is so, like, it's just great that this guy, maybe one of the greatest songwriters of his generation, like, spends the first 5 minutes of this concert just repeating "Stand in the Fire" again and again and again, and it fucking rocks.
There's something about his literary, this show, I think, tends to be about rock songwriting that comes with some kind of literary ambition, and there's definitely different versions of that. And Zevon's is actually, I think you kind of got to something there, that it is kind of like wounded romantic, but also like mentally, like, brain damage romantic. He actually has like a kind of stunted, like, willfully stunted, like, maybe not willfully stunted kind of approach, and like, this is a great example of that, where he's like, okay, he's just doing like a fucking dumb, like, cock rock song to open this record, a record that also has Muhammad's Radio and, like, play it all night long. But he really toes that line, or like, that's the tightrope that he walks. It's like, how much am I going to go full
bimbo mode?
Tropic Thunder, yeah, exactly. R word. But yeah, like, I know I never considered that, but I love the idea that this is his, like, you know, stadium rock, like, jock rock anthem, you know, because it's just like all you guitar players scalding hot, you know, like, it's just the music's there. And like, see that red haired girl in the red silk dress? I'm asking her to dance with me. She might say yes.
I mean, because, look, you know, at the, like, cover of the fucking record.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that to me is like that, the couplet there about the red-haired girl in the red silk dress. I think I'm asking her to dance with me. She might say yes. It's the couplet of turning it back at the last second of saying she might say yes, to me sums up like the Zevon sensibility. Because he's like, he's never like, it's always this like ironic turn at the end. It's never like, oh, like I'm the rock star. Like, you know, yeah, we're getting laid tonight, boys. Like, you know, I'm the rock god. It's always this hint of doubt and vulnerability, and kind of like, this pessimistic view of himself and the world that is like, even in the simplest little two lines, is like, he always turns it around in an unexpected way.
That's a great one to point out. He never just goes fully straight ahead with it.
Because he deserves, obviously, all the confidence in the world at this moment in time. In particular, like, 1980 was kind of his peak in terms of popularity. Bad Luck Streak and Dancing School had just come out. Excitable Boy was a huge hit a couple years earlier. So, like, he deserves to just, like, think, she's going to say yes. It's not she might say yes. And still, you know, he's got this sense of self-doubt and, you know, sort of masked self-loathing that I can't relate to, certainly.
And it's the mismatch between his, like, that's just so good about him, is the ironic mismatch between the music and the lyrics always works so well, because it's like, like you said, it's such a bop, it's such an anthem, but yes, like, always the self-doubt, always the self-loathing, like, always this this apocalyptic view of the world and himself.
It, like, by doing that, he actually is acknowledging that, like, these moments of doubt and weakness also can feel, like, paradoxically, like, that they rock or have, like, a weird, like, this energy to them. He's, like, acknowledging the intensity of even weird little pathetic moments.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, this is why this shit lands. This lands like a fucking uppercut from Tyson,
or like a shot from a gun.
Yes.
What I've done here.
Well done. Excellent segue.
Genie Needs a Shooter is next, and this is, like, easily one of my favorite live cut. I mean, live cuts, so live record. One of my favorite cuts from the record.
Yes,
it really harkens back to his earliest inclinations as a songwriter, where he did Frank and Jesse James, and what amounts to a play on like just any old like cowboy ballad. About, you know, there's that one in particular.
This is basically his own rewrite of Blackjack Davy, or in Bob Dylan parlance, Tin Angel. This, trying to run away with your lady, and then her previous beau tracks you down and shoots you dead along the river.
El Paso.
Yeah, Marty Robbins, the classic. Yeah.
Those songs you mentioned are all the same song too, though.
Yeah,
it's the same one, and like El Paso. Like, I mean, the song is written from the perspective of a guy who's already dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And like, this is the classic Zevon like story song. You know, like this is a tragic and, you know, ironically funny story. This isn't like the real heartbreak ballads, or like this is like, yeah, the classic Zevon story song, you know, a little like country infused. But yeah, again, great, just brilliant song. I love this one.
I was born down by the river where the dirty water flows, and a cold wind cut through me. It cut right through my clothes, and the anger and the yearning like fever.
It sets up the context for these more intimate songs, though, by like peppering in throughout his whole career these songs that are kind of like broader or like more like narrative. That's kind of silly, like Rollin' the Headless Thompson
Rollin',
Gunner.
Yeah,
like that's
or,
another
hit
one.
Some
that's,
hit somebody the
yeah,
hockey,
yeah.
Song.
Hockey song, yeah.
Or even Lures, Guns, and Money to extent. Like there's these songs that kind of like or the Envoy, a great example. I could go on.
Oh yeah,
but these ones that have like. Kind of this like Team America fucking like bit, like almost like South Park like for lack of a I don't even know why I'm making this comparison, but like a like big picture kind of satire feeling. And then he really goes in for other songs with the minutia of individuals more.
Yeah, it's just like there are songs where he lets you inside like the mind of someone, and then there's songs where he like relates the life of someone. Or like the tragic circumstances, he tells a story, like
or the whole world, like
totally.
Global perspective,
like songs. The Envoy,
the Envoy,
based on a real person who I believe was Bill Clinton's ambassador to Lebanon.
Yeah, he's like, I mean, you know, I think you guys have said it on the show a zillion times, but like Zevon really feels like just like the personal like incarnation of like the whole Chapo ethos. It's like, it's uncanny almost the way he just like predicted everything 3 decades in advance.
Except that he was a conservative.
Yeah. Well, we're often accused of that ourselves, but.
Right, exactly.
You know, yeah.
I mean, who knows what he even believed? It's not important.
He believed in having a good time.
Yeah.
Well, he was.
Sure.
Yeah, he was hard
too
as
much.
Hell on it.
Actually.
It was hard as hell on ex-wives.
Yeah.
Let's just keep rolling here because we got a lot to hit. Excitable Boy.
Well,
I mean,
I'll just say that song, Genie Needs a Shooter, is about a completely misguided macho persona of this guy who gets killed for being totally out of touch with pursuing a woman. And then Excitable Boy is just like, I'm sorry. It goes back directly to what I was saying earlier, which is this is literally a song about severe brain damage.
I mean, like, Excitable Boy is probably like the most popular, like the most well known example of what I was talking about earlier of the hilarious mismatch between the tone of the music and the melody, and the lyrics and like the way he sings it, because the places he goes in this song and like the sing-songy way in which he gets there of
the speed,
know, like, a serial killer necrophiliac is essentially what this song is about. Excitable boy, they all said. It's like saying, like, you know, the guy, he was always a quiet neighbor. It was just, oh, yeah, that's just him. He's an excitable boy, you know?
It's incredible. Probably the most joyous sounding song that has ever been committed to tape that includes the words rape and kill. It's just like an infectious fucking sing-along song with the most fucked up dark lyrics that you can possibly imagine.
It's so jaunty and fun, and yeah, no, but was it like built a cage with her bones? Yeah, you can just see, oh man.
And it implies that the character is, I never thought about it before, but kind of suggests that he's well off enough that he's just, like, he's let out of the home and, like, everyone just kind of shrugs off the behavior. Like,
he's deconstructing toxic masculinity from the upper middle class, Evan, don't you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's what I was saying, for sure.
Also, the sequel to Little Susie by the Everly Brothers, the Little Susie in the song is that Little Susie because he played in the Everly Brothers backing band in the 70s. God.
Yeah, and you can really hear the Everly Brothers influence on this song.
Totally.
Like the backing vocals. Yeah. And exactly. Just, yeah, like, so yeah, he's doing that kind of like he's taking the Everly Brothers, like their sound and their influence on him and doing this kind of like one of these sort of like lovesick ballads from like the early era of rock and roll, but making it in like, you know, post 70s, yeah, about a serial killer.
He also, it should be noted, for this whole entire performance, but this song in particular, along with a couple others that come later, he sounds like the devil.
When he went down to dinner, hit his Sunday best, excitable boy, they all said. And he rubbed the pot roast all over his chest. Excitable boy, they all said.
Like, he has come out of the pits of hell and is just like screaming into the microphone with the force of all seven circles of fire and brimstone and bullshit. And like, he sounds incredible on this record.
No, and like, this is what I mean about like very, very few of the live recordings where like the live part of it really makes it like, why wouldn't I just listen to the studio version?
The studio,
of this?
Okay, exactly.
Like on the regular, yeah, exactly. Like, but like, it's because of like the raggedness of his voice in places that you can hear. Just it, like, it doesn't make it like he's not saying it badly. He's killing all these songs, but it's like in the imperfections of it that it really communicates something additional to what like the already perfect studio recording does.
Yeah, you can just like picture him in your fucking mind up there on the stage of the Roxy, just like, I mean, the cover photo like encapsulates all of it, just like gyrating and shoving his pelvis like out into the crowd, and there's these crazy like lights that are flashing all over the place. Like, it just looks like the greatest rock and roll concert you could possibly ever hope to attend.
It was the reason I ever listened. Probably anyone would listen to it. It's a great choice for a cover.
I love the contrast between the front and also the back, because he just looks like kind of a fucking doof here.
He looks like a dork. Like that. Exactly. That's like the front cover. You can see like the energy he's bringing is rock god. But he's dressed like kind of, other than his long hair, he just has these big glasses and he's dressed kind of conservatively.
He looks like a grad student.
He looks like a dork. Yeah. Like, but the swag is just undeniable. It's just a limitless swag.
Yeah, that's what the next live record that they dig up out of the archives will be called, Warren Zevon Limitless Swag.
I don't think that swag was the thing. I don't think he knew about swag, but he knew about swag.
He had a sense for it. Mohammed's Radio.
Oh man,
what's like, this song about?
It's about Islam.
it's about the malaise of the 70s. It's about, you know, like again, like I couldn't really tell you what this song is really about, other than I think like my interpretation of it is it's like, you know, his very sardonic encapsulation of like the Carter moment in America. And like, you know, like, and you can, like I said, like, it's one of those moments on this song where like the imperfections in his voice like made me really kind of like a line in his song really resonate with me in a way that it never had before listening to the studio version of it on the self-titled debut album. But when he goes, you know, even Jimmy Carter's got the highway blues. It's
such
like
a
the
great
way he
line.
Sings it. It's just like that to me sums up what the song's about, because it's about like, you know, like even the Ayatollah, you know, like, and so from the Ayatollah to Jimmy Carter, everyone's listening to Muhammad's radio, and it's like, you know, like the OPEC oil strike, the Iran hostage crisis, and just like Jimmy Carter and gas prices. It's like this, yeah, this very wry, sardonic encapsulation of this moment in American history that's gone now, but like still perennially relevant.
They work all day, they still can't pay the price of gasoline and
meats. I was just gonna bring it up. I love that. Still can't pay the price of gasoline and meat.
Meat.
The price of gasoline and meat.
Yeah, and alas, their lives are incomplete. And it's just like, that's what I mean about like, alas, their lives are incomplete. It's just like the shortest, simplest little like rhyme with meat. But again, just introduces this like mournful, like existential, that's like instantly relatable. It's like, because, yeah, if you can't afford food and to put gas in your car, like, yeah, your life is incomplete. And that's it's such a funny or like ironic way of like simply encapsulating like the despair of like, yeah, you know, America. And it's this kind of like I said, exquisite resignation to like mediocrity and kind of like also ran status or declining power as a nation.
Yeah, diminished horizons, totally.
I mean, I don't know if this is intentional or not with like the title of the song, Muhammad's Radio, but I always thought it was funny, like a funny like meaning to read into the song is like Muhammad's Radio is funny because you cannot depict Muhammad, obviously, like
yes,
that person visually.
Jesus.
So I love the idea of Muhammad's radio station where you can absolutely represent his voice
him.
Or what he sounds like. Yeah.
Muhammad was a podcaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those lines or choruses, I think, that like Hasten Down the Wind or Accidentally Like a Martyr or something, where like it's, you kind of don't ever know exactly what he's getting at when you're reading the words on the page, right? But like the way he sings it, the way the music sounds behind it, kind of the emotion and the spirit that he puts into it, like you just hear him say it, like you get what he's saying, you know, even if you don't get what he's saying.
He's a poet, you know, but he really picks and chooses when to employ like one poetic idea, which might just be a line like Muhammad's Radio or Hasten Down the Wind or what was the third one that you mentioned?
Accidentally Like a Martyr.
Yeah, Accidentally Like a Martyr is a great example where it's like he believes in whatever that line is, even if it's a little abstract, a little out there.
Right.
And then he sells it by having a song around it that feels really cohesive emotionally, lyrically.
Yeah, it makes sense to him. You know, he believes it, so you can believe it, even if you don't know what the fuck he's talking about, literally.
It's like, to me, it's like the equivalent to people that try to parse every detail in a David Lynch film because they think it'll unlock this mystery, where it's just like, no, like, people who think it doesn't make sense are people who try to, like, view every clue like a detective rather than people who just, like, watch the movie and let it like sort of commune with it on an emotional level, because then that's when it makes sense. And even if you can't really like explain it in a one-to-one thing of like, oh, I can tell you like what the blue key meant to him at that moment, or like this is what unlocks some fucking greater like Rosetta Stone to figuring it all out. It's like, no, that's not important. It's the emotional truth of it, and the emotional veracity of it is so deeply felt. And like Desperados Under the Eaves, like I could tell you my theories about what I think that song is actually about, but it's just like the fun is in interpreting it and like just sort of what it means to you.
Radio.
Don't the trees look like crucified thieves? Like, he really does go out there with the poetic imagery pretty often, but it's peppered through it. Like, that happens in the midst of Werewolves of London type songs. So, right. Like, which itself is actually, like, kind of like what we call when Bob Dylan gets into a certain lane, what we might call wiggle mode. The song Wiggle Wiggle by Bob Dylan, I'm sure you know, Will.
I'm not familiar with that one.
I'm shocked.
Do you agree that, Ian, that Werewolves of London is kind of a wiggle mode, like wiggle pill type of
sort of
expression?
Yeah, he is in wiggle adjacent mode here. I mean, this one is hard to, like, and this is the next song on the set list, so we can just keep rolling right along. It's sort of hard to think about from that perspective, just because it has, like, this is when you say Warren Zevon to 10 people on the street, 9 of them, if they even know who the fuck he is, they think werewolves. And like you were saying, well, with, like, Color of Money, it's got that whole thing. It's just, like, turned into, like, the song of Warren Zevon's that anyone who knows him knows. It's got, like, which is great that he had such an amazing big hit like this, but also, like, I feel like it has kind of been robbed of a little bit of the, not subversiveness, but, like, the, you know, whatever degree of artistic merit it had initially, because it just kind of got turned into a, like, kitschy, like, sing-along
barbecue song,
exactly, which is a great thing to have There's no shame in that. You know?
It's actually, as I'm thinking more about it, it's not that different from anything like Subterranean Homesick Blues or like any of the earlier Dylan, like Everybody Must Get
Rolling
Stone,
yeah.
Or Rainy Day Women, I mean, you know.
Yeah, but unlike all of those songs, like, I mean, this one is obviously the most popular Zevon song because it has, like, like the piano in it is just so catchy from the first notes of the song. Just that over and over again. It's so catchy. It's a real earworm, and, you know, like the lyrics, like, don't really matter. You know, like, you could tell why this was his, like, the breakout Warren Zevon song.
Right.
It's just Warren's feel, like, really put on a plate for you. It just how his energy. I didn't have the thought recently that he's a little bit like the American John Cale.
Because
he literally did study with avant-garde classical musicians as a young man.
Yeah.
Plays piano. Yeah.
Right.
And plays piano and, like, goes really gross out there sometimes. Like, literally he's screaming and, like, I don't know. There's a certain willingness that they share to get really foul in the context of rock music. And throw themselves out there in a way that's like,
sure.
I think they just they meet at a couple points. They're very different guys. But,
they meet in that they are the locus of Jokerman podcast.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the cool thing about this live version of Werewolves of London is that he adds in, like, a whole one or two other verses that you never heard before. He includes shout outs to James Taylor and Brian De Palma. So, you know.
Brian De Palma again.
Yeah, when you got Brian De Palma again, like, you know, you got no complaint. In fact, you know, I'm loving it even more because, like, all the added verses about the werewolf and what he's up to.
And don't forget Jackson. I saw Jackson Browne walking slow down the avenue. Yeah. You know, his hair was perfect.
And when he says, like, then they're looking for James Taylor.
You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim.
You bring up Jackson Browne. I remember there's some detail from one of the various biographies of Warren Zevon, but it talks about, like, this is a time in which, like, Jackson Browne was basically, like, his only friend in the music industry.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like, after he'd been, like, you know, in and out, like, out of rehab and, like, disowned by most people. And he, the story goes that he showed up at Jackson Browne's wedding and pulled up in a car in which he was firing a revolver out of the driver's side window, screaming,
Jesus,
we're going to run him out of town. We're going to string him up. So I just think of that when he shouts out Jackson Browne, when he says, we're looking for James Taylor. Like, I'm just thinking he's going to hunt him down and kill him or something.
Yeah. Bite his throat out.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks like the kind of guy who would do that on the fucking cover of this record.
Jackson Browne, I want to know more about their friendship, actually, because, like, Jackson Browne seems like such a sweet man, and by all accounts he is. And this is just like it, I imagine it being a little bit like a great buddy comedy.
Oh yeah,
Yeah, Warren and Jackson both seem like such like distinctive like mid late 70s Los Angeles personalities, but just like the id and the ego, but just like the complete opposite ends of whatever continuum that is, from like psycho mode to just like chilled out good vibes playing the guitar kind of stuff from Jackson Brown.
I should mention that I just saw Jackson Brown play live.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was nice, you know.
Cool.
I was the youngest person there, and he played at least three songs about how he's not racist, and you know, it was good.
It's important to include in all your live performances.
It's just very sweet music. He sounds great. He looks healthier than most Americans.
My dad's a big Jackson Brown guy. I'll get there eventually. He again sounds like a devil or a werewolf, literally, in this song. Always love the lines about Trader Vic's and the werewolf eating beef chow mein at Lee Ho Fuck's also. It's just, you know, it's those little lines. I don't know. Like, that's like a quintessential Zvonism. Looking for a place called Lee Ho Fuck's, going to get a big dish of beef chow mein. Like, the only person I can picture writing a line like that is Donald Faken.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
It would come out completely differently.
I also like that in the original recording of this song, he cycles through, he shouts out both Lon Chaney and Lon Chaney Jr.
You got to come up.
You know, because in a lot, you know, I don't know if you may be aware or not, but it was actually Lon Chaney Jr. was the Wolfman, not his dad, who was the Phantom of the Opera.
Warren Zevon, apparently a big movie mindset kind of guy.
Oh, yeah,
dedicating
definitely.
It to Marty with all these movie references and stuff in here. He loved,
he's got some,
the pictures.
Got some film reference, but he's also a huge book guy. You know, he's probably one of the most well-read rock stars of all time.
Imagine he read a lot of, you know, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, all the noir, James Ellroy kind of stuff.
Speaking of which...
Our James Ellroy book come to life.
Probably his masterpiece of a certain kind of masterpiece, of a certain type of writing that he does. I mean, it's like that desperate male ego. Like this is kind of a very particular corner that gets totally given the Hollywood treatment on this song. Like,
I'm a desperate man. Like, dad, get me out of this, you know, like,
dad.
And and you know, like you know, a great piece of like, you know, Cold War satire, or like, you know, again, like, you know, just this like very simple but like just like hilarious encapsulation of like, you know, American Cold War mindset. And once again, like from the first two lines in the song, I went home with a waitress the way I often do. How was I to know she was with the Russians too? You know, once again, it's like you can't just be taking home a waitress the way I always do. You know, like I'm the man. But then again, it's like, how was I to know she was with the Russians? Like, you know, he's just like someone who's just destroyed his life, you know, but he can't help it. He can't stop himself. Yeah.
She was with the Russians too almost implies that this just happened previously.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This just happened.
In media reds.
This is the second night in a row that he's fucked a Russian spy by mistake and gotten like kidnapped.
The riff also, I mean, like we haven't talked about the music too much because obviously there's so much to talk about just on the lyrical standpoint with Zevon, but just like I can't imagine more. And like anytime the studio version and especially this live version when those fucking guitar chords come in, I'm just like, I'm throwing my head back and getting whiplash. It sounds so fucking huge. also should be noted, like, because, you know, I think there could be, you know, sort of baby-brained interpretations of a lot of Zevon stuff like this, or Excitable Boy, where, you know, he's endorsing toxic masculinity or whatever. But, like, a song that doesn't make this set, and one that I've always loved, is, like, Veracruz.
Such a heartbreaking song.
Yeah. Such a great song, and such a really thoughtful and considerate and, like, shockingly kind of ahead of its time, like anti-colonialist.
It's about American imperialism. It's exactly. About the first really imperial president, Woodrow Wilson.
I heard Woodrow Wilson's guns. Yeah, it's like...
Actually,
like
Teddy Roosevelt, I guess, would be the first. But yeah, I heard Woodrow Wilson's guns, yeah.
It's just like, you know, the guy that can write this song and the guy that can write that song, it's just like fucking... It's amazing.
It's because... His songs like this, his songs about like tortured, pathetic, fucked up men with too much power or none, like those are, those only really work because he's like at risk of being, it's like that quote about like fascism, like a critique of it is only compelling by someone who's tempted by it.
Right.
He's kind of like that, you know, he's definitely not, there's been times when he wasn't just tempted, he was like in the shit. Of like being a man who's not doing the right thing, and then waking up how many days of his life and knowing that he did the wrong thing and writing a song about it.
Right.
And like, and Lars Guns of Money, it's like, there's not that many lyrics in it. It's not that long a song. Like there's only like really two verses in it and then just the chorus. But to me, it's just like, it once again, a perfect encapsulation, like a perfect short biography of what I imagine basically everyone who worked for the CIA and State Department in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the people who managed like the second Cold War in America.
Yeah, exactly. They put this song on and they just enjoy it like completely straight-facedly, like with no degree.
Yeah, it's
of,
like how guys in finance love They're American like, Psycho, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Or Wolf of Wall Street. It's like, damn, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, that is me.
My life a song.
My life a song.
That's yeah, my life a song.
My life a song sounds so like
imagine
fabulous.
Imagine say, as a brag though, my life a Warren Zevon song. You know, then
exactly. Yeah.
That's like red flags all over the place.
Yeah, you're either having a really, really good time or a really,
yeah,
really
worst
bad time.
Ever.
Yeah.
It's a good time to bring up that you know, I don't know how many times I've been like to a girl like Warren Zevon, you know, that song Werewolves of London, that's him. But he has other stuff too.
You got to watch out for that. You're treading in dangerous waters with that,
brother. It's
wish
it's
it,
all,
would
it's
that
always
it weren't
there.
So, you know, yeah. we're doing the work of, you know, getting the three women who listen to our show to
I have Excitable Boy on my dance playlist for my wedding at the moment. I don't know if it's actually going to make the final cut, but like fingers crossed.
Brothers, just know that there is hope. I have successfully after fitful starts and, you know, like a bit of trying, I have successfully Zevon pilled Catherine.
And all it took
was once again, Desperados Under the Eaves.
There you go.
There it is.
Once she heard that song, it was all over.
Yeah, that one, and I've got Mutineer going too. I think that's going to be...
Oh my God. Oh, my heart.
It's like what we don't get on this record is any of that other side of Warren's.
Well, you don't get really the kind of like the second half of his career, but like this is just like all the fucking...
No, something bad happened to a clown, unfortunately.
No, but what we do get is, like you alluded to earlier, Will, another song that just appears nowhere else, which is The Sin.
The Sin, yeah.
How are you going to pay for it?
It's like the closest he gets to like a new wave, like straight up new wave type of sound, I think. Like,
yeah, totally.
It kind of sounds almost like a different artist.
A little bit punky, a little kind of. Like Elvis Costello-y almost?
Yeah, definitely. Like Elvis Costello is more like almost like proto-goth type sounding stuff.
I mainly, like from this song, I just think like the one thing that always stands out to me is the line, "Now I'm not saying that you should give a sucker an even break. I'm talking about the times in which you were cruel for cruelty's sake. How are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for the sin?" So like once again, like... Yeah, like, no, it's like, again, perfect Zevon sensibility. Mm. It's not a sin to rook the gullible and exploit people. No, the real sin, the true evil is being cruel for cruelty's sake. And I kind of agree with that. Like, I think kind of an interesting, like, moral view of the world.
It's a profound idea that's just in this one song, and a song that never makes it, but it gives you kind of a hint into his songwriting process a little bit. Like, this is a really good line, and there can be a song built around it. And I think it's a compelling enough idea to make that work.
Totally. And just the idea that, like, the sins that you'll be called to account for when you're dead are, like, not the sins that everyone does on, like, a day-to-day basis, which are, like, you know, white lies, I don't know, cheating on your taxes, or, you know, like, stepping out on a girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. It's the sadism. It's the things that in which you cause harm to people for no other reason than it delights you.
Right.
Yeah. It's really interesting in the light of everything we've been saying to think about him, you know, as this, like, totally, he's totally guilty of all of these petty and not so petty crimes. This song is kind of like, yeah, I know that I am fucked up, but, like, you know that I'm right about this thing.
Presumably somewhat inspired by, he was going through his divorce from his wife at this time. Like, they were,
you don't,
like,
say.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I can sort of imagine that being a lot of the kind of fuel behind writing a song like this, and then B, also the reason this song never made a record, you know, in the light of day, maybe a little ways down the line when he had a cooler head, didn't seem like the kind of thing he wanted to commit to wax, you know, for
eternity.
That's
pretty icky. It's pretty gross.
I mean, he already committed the French inhaler to wax, which is just about the most brutal, the most, that up there with No Vaseline is just about the most brutal diss track anyone's ever done, except it's about your ex-wife.
Yeah, poor, poor, pitiful me. It's just like, okay. This is easily one of my favorite ones of Boys, all time, because it's that thing.
This is about at exactly the halfway point in this live album. And this is, like, this to me is the highlight of the whole album. Because, this is a song that, like, again, like, you know, a great song, but when I heard it on Standing in the Fire, though, this version of it just unlocked the whole hidden chamber. Like, this is a totally different song to me than the one that's on the album because of, like, just how hard this song goes.
Poor, poor, pitiful me. Poor, poor, pitiful me. These young girls won't let me be. Lord have mercy on me.
The long guitar solo and when it really just kicks in the breakdown, and then and this is the moment that I've been waiting for, because this is the moment on the live album that has just, like, where he gets into, like, the patented Zevon stage patter, and when he just starts going, where's George Gruhl? George Gruhl, my road manager, my best friend, get on stage and dance, get on stage and dance or I'll kill you, and I got the means.
I said, where's George Gruhl? My road manager, my best friend, come on out here, George.
Oh, God, that's just so funny and so cool. And you could just hear, like, that. You could just feel the energy and just, like, how much fun he's having. And just that whole room is just rocking. And then just, like I said, like, the long guitar solo in this, when it just, like, it just kicks up. If I'm listening to this in my car, I have to, like, be really careful I'm not, like, blatantly speeding. Because, like, foot just gets heavier and heavier on the accelerator.
The landscape just rushing by slightly faster. It's his best song.
Oh, I mean, any Zevon song can be his best song at a given
moment.
Best
rock bop. I mean, for my money, it's probably
poor, pitiful me. I mean, just that the chorus, poor, poor, pitiful me. These young girls. Let me be. Lord have mercy on me.
Yeah, it's just once again, like, he's the victim here, you know? Like, yeah. And it's like, the fact that the song is fully aware of that irony is just like, is what makes it so exquisite and perfect. You know, I lay my head on the railroad tracks waiting for the double E. And once again, like, the railroad don't come no more. Yeah, just trying to kill yourself by having a train run over your head and failing.
That was always like,
and trying to kill yourself just because you're getting laid too much.
You're getting too much pussy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, normally I say that I can't relate to songs, but I have to make an exception here.
Yeah, exactly. This, between that and the, you know, the railroad fixation and threatening to murder your manager, just like all things that we all are very, very related to.
Yeah, trains, you know, something we all think so much about.
Trains, having sex, and wanting to kill yourself. That is the holy triumvirate of, you know, what makes a man, you know?
Yeah. So his best song is Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me.
I love that he also just mentioned, just briefly, the Jesse James line, like, she was just like Jesse James. This song also comes on the self-titled, really his first debut record, Warren Zevon, that starts with Frank and Jesse James. Like, just the way that he does that, and he meets this girl in West Hollywood, like, I feel like he does a really good job of just, like, creating the Warren Zevon, like, universe kind of thing with these characters and place names, and, like, the way they pop up in different songs and in different contexts. Like, he's got a really, just such a tangible, well-defined sense of time and place and worldview. You know, he rocks. Sleep When I'm Dead.
So much to do. Spend me on the bar. I sleep when I'm dead. Saturday night, I'd like to raise a little heart. I sleep when I'm dead.
I mean, to go from Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me right into I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, like I said,
it's a seamless transition.
It just goes right into it. Yeah, it just doesn't stop. And, like, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, again, like, another, like, that song just does not let up. And on this live album, like, just to go from the energy of Poor, Poor, Pitiful Me into I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, like, these two songs here, this is, like, the climax of it. And then it's a slow bringing you down to, like, the really heartbreaking final song on this album. But, like, these two songs, this is the most rock and roll. Like, this is rock and roll at its apex, you know, like, just both songs, like, again, there's no pause in between them. They don't let up. Listen to these songs back to back. This is just like, you know, this is like, I don't know, like what Jesse Ventura must have felt shooting that minigun in Predator.
Like, yeah, that is what this is like.
It's almost like a little song suite or something. I've got a 44 Magnum up on the shelf, and I don't intend to use it on myself. I'll sleep. I fucking love that line.
He, in the recorded version, says, if I start acting stupid, I'll shoot myself. And I took that moment where he doesn't say that. I was actually kind of like, oh, like, did he just have, like, is that, like, hit too close to home for something, like, recent near this performance? Like, is he, like, not trying to talk about killing himself? So he's like, all right, I don't want to do that, but
what's the next best thing?
I'll use it on
George Gruhl.
Well, yeah. That's the funniest, like, that's why his genius as a songwriter is the things that he doesn't say. Yeah. He's like, I got a 44 Magnum up on the shelf. I don't intend to use it on myself. But, like, I mean, what that implies is that he's going to kill someone with it. He's going to murder someone with this 44 Magnum, but it's just not suicide.
There's a gun in the song, and no matter what way he's going to employ the lyric, like, somebody is dying after the song.
They call that Zevon's gun. It's a literary conceit.
Yeah, Zevon's gun. Yes. Warren's gun. Yeah.
It will be fired into his own mouth once it's introduced. Yeah. But, what's left unsaid here? Who does he fire the 44 Magnum at? The audience and anyone listening to these two songs back to back.
That's right.
Because you're dead after this. Like, he he R.I.P. He just killed the Roxy with these two songs here. This is, I mean, like, if the album could have ended here. The album could have just ended here.
It really could have.
And actually, the album does end with the next track. Okay. We're running through the Spotify version, which is a little extended based off the original one. But this is, we're coming in for the landing on the original record. Bo Diddley's A Gunslinger takes us out from the original version. Just another, just one-off, unique creation that never saw any other recording,
it's a cover. It's a cover.
Oh, is it a cover?
Yeah, it's a cover of Bo Diddley. Bo Diddley is a lover as a record, and Bo Diddley is a gunslinger. Title of track is, or the first track is this. It's just a song about how in this record, Bo Diddley is a gunslinger.
You're right.
Bo Diddley's a gunslinger. Bo Diddley's a gunslinger. Bo Diddley's a gunslinger. Bo Diddley's a gunslinger.
Like, his affection for Bo Diddley and covering this Bo Diddley song goes back to what I said, like, about Warren Zevon being your favorite artist.
Right.
If you take that out one more degree of, like, the who are, like the hidden gems, like the guys who inspire everyone, the guy who inspired all of them is Bo Diddley. And that's equally true for our boy Marky Smith, who regarded Bo Diddley as the greatest musician of all time. He was obsessed with him. He was the only musician that Marky Smith ever met at a music festival that he showed any respect or like kindness to was Bo Diddley. He's the only one he didn't throw a bottle at or just harass or abuse in some other way. But yeah, like Bo Diddley was like a true rock and roll innovator, like one of the most unheralded but greatest of all time. And like, you know, anyone who's a rock musician, almost all of them, and you can read this in like so many biographies, or if you'd like dig into the catalogs of like just any like major influential rock artist, they all revere Bo Diddley above basically everyone else.
Right.
Yeah. He invented, in Warren's own words, about Bob Dylan, he invented his job, man. He said, yeah.
My dad was a huge Bo Diddley fan. I think he actually got the chance to see him live one time.
He said,
Bo Diddley was like his sound, like for rock and roll, is that he was a guy who played his electric guitar like percussions, like a drum set.
Yeah.
He made the electric guitar sound like a percussion section. Like he played the guitar like the drums, and like it's just that raw, stripped down like rock and roll beat, like that's Bo Diddley, and it makes, and also like the perversity of his song lyrics and the stories he tells, it matches perfectly with Zevon's sensibility.
Yeah,
and you listen to this kind of music, like I've been thinking about this a lot lately, but it's like I live in Los Angeles and I go to fucking shows at Zebulon like everybody else, and when somebody plays anything that's even if it just comes on the PA, like when a song is like actually just rock music, like old school rock and roll, I feel like if everybody kind of is breathing like a little collective sigh of relief, like people actually want to hear this stuff played more now. And I think it's time for it to sort of make a return. I feel like we need to turn off rock music and just turn it back on again for people to like remember how great the simple things are.
Like, sounds like you're advocating for a return to rockabilly right now.
Music that rocks.
Music that rocks.
Thank you, Will.
To music that rocks in a simpler way, a simpler time.
Like, it was when rock music wasn't self-conscious. This was like before the Beatles changed everything.
Someone should come up with like a saying or something that they repeat again and again on their dumbass podcast. Something like I love rock songs.
Yeah. Well,
hey, brother, if you don't love rock songs, I'm not trying to hear from you.
Hell yeah.
This is when rock music wasn't self-conscious, but it was like full of humor. So, like it didn't need to be fucking self-conscious. It was swag.
Right.
You know, it just had swag.
Exactly. And so then the record, this version, the Spotify, or for the folks at home, to make your lives easy, we're just going based off the Spotify streaming version. We get a couple other songs that didn't actually take place, I think, in the set list where they're appearing on the record, but they're just kind of tacked on here at the end. You can hear some weird kind of cuts in between them. But they're, again, four additional just all-time Warren songs, starting with Johnny Strikes Up the Band, the first track for Excitable Boy, which is such an anthemic, like, just like, we're back to kind of Stand in the Fire mode, back to kind of Bimbo mode, just like revving up the audience and having a good time.
I mean, I guess this is probably the song on this album I probably have like the least to say about. I think it's a great song. Same. It's just like, it's a fun, upbeat song, but it's just like, you know, I love the album version. I like the live version, but it's just like, to me, like this one is the one that like resonates the least with me probably, which is to say it resonates a lot. But like, I this is probably like the one I, you know, that's like the most like, you know, off, you know, like if I would substitute one song out on, it would probably be this one.
Right.
Yeah.
Not the most essential here. I do love the way that he pronounces projects in here as Prohe.
I'll be rocking in a Prohe. Walking down along the strand.
in some sort of weird, I'm guessing, nod to the Latino heritage of Los Angeles. But Freddie getting ready, rock steady when Johnny strikes up the band. Easy as that. Played all night long.
Grandpa pissed his pants again. He don't give a damn. Brother Billy has both guns drawn. He ain't been right since Vietnam. Sweet Hope Alabama, play that dead band song. Turn those speakers up for blast.
This song is like, when I talk about his like his cruelty and like not giving a fuck, this song is just as a Gucci man just implored people not to do, is dissing the dead. He is taking a whole, he is just taking a huge piss on like the smoldering wreckage of Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane. God. What a fucking haunting song.
Yeah.
When I first heard this song, like I had no idea, like it was just, I had no idea what to make of it. The lyrics were so weird, but the sound of it, the melody of it was just so stirring and eerie and, like you said, frightening. Like it's just, it's so like, God, just like the plaintive, like repetitive. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how to describe it. This song in any version gives me chills.
Same, chills. It's one of his, I didn't even put that together consciously, but just like Cale's Heartbreak Hotel, it interpolates a song that everyone knows into it in this way where it's completely changing the context and really makes you like reflect on things. It's another example of a rock song reflecting upon the very young history of rock music, but it's just like one of these great landmarks of the first time that was done in a way that was really artistically daring and fulfilling, and happens to be really fucked up.
I mean, like, because the song really it makes you sing that Sweet Home Alabama, like that,
yeah,
that chorus. I mean,
yeah, that's the riff, exactly.
But just changes the meaning of it like so intensely. Sweet Home Alabama, play that dead band song. You know, like just like the ultimate kiss off to Skynyrd and their fans is just like that dead band who sung about the South, and like. And, you know, they were from Florida. They weren't even really from the South. But like horrific and mean portrayal of like rural Southern life. Sweat, piss, jizz, and blood. And like,
don't forget Daddy's doing Sister Sally. Grandma's dying of cancer now.
And then as Letterman said to him in one of his Letterman appearances, he was about this song, he was like, as far as I know, and like we've researched this, you're the only songwriter in history that has ever worked the word brucellosis into a song.
You know,
I love how ugly and mean-spirited the song is on one level, and then at the same time, like, paints sort of a sympathetic portrait.
Oh, absolutely. This is what, like, I mean about this, like, this wounded humanism. Like, it is such an incredibly mean song, but you listen to it, the feeling in it is just so heart-wrenching and just
mournful.
It's so mournful and just tragic. It's just, yeah.
Totally.
It transcends just sort of cheap, easy mockery of people from the South or like Lynyrd Skynyrd and their fan base.
No, I mean, Weird Al doesn't make songs that are sad, you know? But this is kind of what happens when you like do something where you take a song and parody it. And then you think about like, you know, there's caricatures that are like goofy, and then there's caricatures that are grotesques, and this is a real grotesque caricature.
Yeah. Or like this, if you were to compare this song to Weird Al's canon, this would be the equivalent of Weird Al's "Dare to Be Stupid," which wasn't It was an original song, but it was done in the style of Devo.
Right.
But he did a Devo song so good that like Mark Mothersbaugh wanted to kill him for it. He was just like.
It probably stung a bit. That
like, yeah, he was like, you wrote a better Devo song than I can fucking do.
Beat him
like,
in his own game, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
The live version also is just incredible. It's great. Like, the cut we get on this, right? Just the way the band, because you get this one really rides that synth riff, I think, all throughout. And that's a tone that they don't use a whole lot through the set.
You really don't hear that.
Not a big time synth guy, except for on a certain record.
Like on this record in particular, when those synths come through, like it really kind of it's a really gripping kind of striking sound, and the way they just like drive it into the ground for the last 90 seconds or something is like. It's got that kind of funereal quality to it.
Yeah, it seems like a dirge.
Military dirge. Exactly. Yeah. Oh man, it's fucking brutal. One of his greatest songs.
What a stunning song. That to me is like one of his best songs. Like it's
totally
the most singular, like the most sort of stands apart from all of his other work as just like, I have no idea where that song comes from. But
no
man,
one other than
like,
Warren Zevon could have ever written that song.
Yeah, it's incredible.
There ain't much to country living. Sweat, piss, cheers, and blood. Sweet hope, Alabama. Play that dead band song. Turn those speakers up full blast. Play it all. Up full blast and play it all night long. Yes!
To segue in, I mean, it does have this sort of martial quality to it, and it does reference Vietnam. Brother Billy has both guns drawn. He ain't been right since Vietnam. That sort of idea of like the actually talking about empire and trauma and warfare actually is something that pops up again and again, and I feel like it might be, you know, it's kind of at the core of that song in some ways. He then goes into, or the record goes into, Frank and Jesse James, which actually he starts with a sort of piano version of. It's the beginning of Desperados?
Well, I mean, Desperados and Frank and Jesse James like have a very similar kind of melody. So I don't know that it's like meant to be that in this version necessarily, but I think that's kind of part of the thing of the whole first record is it starts with Frank and Jesse James and ends with Desperados as sort of a cycle, and it's like sort of the same song.
It's a history song. It's a song that when you listen to it, you learn a little something about American history.
That's right.
Yeah.
He really tickles the ivories on this one. This is like a very jaunty piano song. Once again, the irony is that it's a pay-in. And it's like a hagiographic portrait of these like Confederate marauders.
Murdering gangsters.
These murdering gangsters who like, you know, didn't want to end the Civil War because they wanted to keep owning black people. But, you know, like in transposed to like the great myth of the American outlaw and the bank robber, it's like, you know, they rode against the railroad and they rode against the banks. They rode against the governor. Never did they ask for a word of thanks. You know, like it's just like these guys are murdering innocent people, but like they're stealing from the rich. So
they're doing it out of the kindness of their hearts.
They're not giving to the poor, but like, don't we all wish we could do that? Don't we all wish, you know, it's like the Goodfellas thing, you know, who went to 9-to-5 jobs and took the train to work were fucking dead to us.
Exactly. Yeah. They rode against the banks and the governor. Who doesn't want to ride against the banks and the governor?
And like for this one, like when it really breaks down into like when it gets into the piano part and it's like dun, 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 this is once again like when I'm listening to this song in my car, I'm driving up on a straightaway, I just start bouncing in my seat and imagining I'm riding a horse. I can't help it. I do it every single time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a romantic song about being a complete degenerate.
You can take it on complete face value and just, like, not think critically whatsoever about anything that he's saying here and just, like, oh, it's a song about cowboys, you know, and he's being romantic about the American West. But then if you could just take that one step beyond and think about, like, after Appomattox, they was on the losing side. I wonder what that means. There's, like, this whole other fucking degree, a dimension to this thing. It is quintessentially Zevon.
The only other person, the only other songwriter I can think of who does this as well and as often is Randy Newman. Sail Away has a similar mission or a similar
I Love LA
approach.
You know,
I Love LA. Exactly. As well. And Short People is not that different from Excitable Boy. You know, just like making a song that is like utterly.
It's just despicable, it's despicable, but like he's daring you not to have fun and like sing along with it, you know?
Yeah.
Indicting his audience. Frank and Jesse James, all timer, and then closes the set at least. And it sounds like it's the last song of whatever, because this concert was recorded over 5 nights and stitched together from a couple different takes, a couple different nights. But whatever night, Hasten Down the Wind, last song on the set, was recorded. This clearly was the closer, and it deserves to be, because he brings
down
the house.
He gives the most stage patter at the beginning of this song. He has a long spoken intro to the song where he talks about how, in his words, this is the song that intervened between myself and starvation, thanks to Ms. Ronstadt, Linda Ronstadt's cover of this song, I think is like first real money that he made in the music industry.
Yep.
But he just says, like, you know, when I wrote the song, I was like, you know, strung out, fucked up. And he's like, well, now I'm just fucked up. But, you know, like, this is a very personal song to him because it was like, you know, the first song he wrote that he ever got any money for. But man, this song, and it's just him on the piano. And it's just him and a piano and his voice. And like this to me, it gets back to like, this is like the quintessential Zevon. This is what made me fall in love with his music, is that like he writes the most utterly painful, the most excruciatingly painful and heartbreaking breakup songs of all time. Just that like, just for like, and you know, the universal experience of a relationship ending or heartbreak. It's just he captures it in a way that like there really no other artist like has ever done before or since, in my opinion. Like, it's just the lyrics in this song are just like, just they're, it's just they feel like, it's just the you just feel the pain of it so much, and it's just like he's holding on to half her heart, but he can't stand the restless part, so he tells her to hasten down the wind. And just that phrase, to hasten down the wind, it, like accidentally like a martyr, is just like such a poetic. Like you could never dream of that phrase, but just like, it's just like it's giving someone a kiss off to send them down the wind to quickly depart, is just, man, like, it's just this song is like to end on this song is just, God, man, it's just the heartbreak. What can I say?
Yeah, it's perfect. The economy, I think, of the words here, and like knowing that he doesn't need to go any further, because he just, that phrase, hasten down the wind, he got it. That's the whole song right there. We don't need much more beyond that. And so the not like the self-restraint to be able to just like keep the focus telescope so tightly in on that phrase, that concept, and just these couple few verses is, and, like,
and,
you know.
And what I love too is that like when Linda Ronstadt sung this song, like it's, like to hear that song sung by a woman, it's like sort of from a woman's perspective, and then you hear it from him, and it's like you sort of assume the male perspective, but he captures both sides of it like just so perfectly. Like he doesn't let anyone off the hook, and just in the chorus, like the you know, she's so many women, and the way he sings that, it's just like, this is a universal thing. This is like every relationship, like every like, you know, she's so many women, he can't find the one who was his friend. God, I'm gonna tear up right now. This is the first time I'm ever gonna cry on a podcast, but like,
hell, he says,
he can't find the one who was his friend. Like, it's just
brutal.
Yeah,
it's a great line in that it clearly is about this specific story, but also she is so many. It's so many women that he's talking about all over. You know,
yeah. It's just, this is just
it's
like
universal too.
This, and like, and or just a repeated pattern. And like, yeah, whether it's a universal thing of like this is a stand-in for like a relationship that everyone's had, or like she's so many women. I've been through this so many times in my own life, and it's the same thing over and over again.
It has a lot of meanings. That one
it's
line.
This tragic predetermination of just like the inability to like break out of these like patterns of behavior in your life, and like to repeat the same heartbreak over and over again.
There's something about the title too, where like you said, you know, hasten meaning implying like quick. It's like get it over with. I know the next one's coming. Just get out of here.
Just gut wrenching. It feels like just like a cold knife stuck in your gut, but like, or just you feel like, you know, in your chest, you know, that's what heartbreak really feels like. It feels like a real physical sensation. And like, like you said, Ian, his economy of style, and just like, just with the fewest words imaginable, just like how much feeling he can evoke in just like the simplest possible way is just, it's stunning to me. And like, just again, after an album that rocks so hard, to like, to just close it out, at least on the Spotify version, with just like this just very plaintive ballad, is just, it's so intimate and it's so personal. Like, it's just, it's astonishing.
Yeah. Clearly the way the whole kind of record, I think, should have ended, as good, as great as Bo Diddley's A Gunslinger is as a closer, like this one really just takes it to another level. I think also like in the performance, that moment in the middle of it, when he kind of like breaks out and he says, "Turn up the house lights. I've found the ones who were my friends." And then the audience, like that's, that makes my heart melt. You know, and just like knowing who Zevon was and how, you know, kind of how the rest of his career would go, and how he constantly kind of was searching for the artistic fulfillment and critical and commercial success that he had at one time and then kind of gambled away. And it's just like, man, it fucking breaks my heart just listening to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit, if there's one part that it almost just is like a little too much for me, it's that one. It's like, it's almost, it's a little bit like, it's just so close to
poor sweet Prince. Warren, look at him. Love the guy.
Yeah, the record just doesn't, it doesn't have a lot of those sad songs. It doesn't have a lot of his more, his mournful ballads, which are probably my favorites of his, but it does have one that I think like makes up for.
Oh yeah. You only need one. And like, this is a live album, so you don't want to just like make people want to lay their head on the railroad track, waiting for the double exactly. E after they leave the fucking concert. If it had been 13 songs of all of his, like, you know, from Genius to, you know, Heartache Spoken Here, Bed of Coals, what's the one? One of my favorite Zevon lines, where I never thought I'd be alone like this. Guessed I should have been a realist.
Yeah, well, that line really sums up something that I feel like this record speaks to, which is like, we talk a lot about Zevon being kind of like a desperate, or like the poet laureate of like desperate men everywhere, and this record kind of shows like his high octane, running as fast as he can side.
Yeah.
And he's the type of guy, or the type of artist, who you get the feeling like the minute he slows down at all, it all just like the really dark, like deep,
the darkness just encroaches.
Instantly starts rising up. He's constantly having to run so fast and belt so hard, scream so loud, just because he knows like, he's
just
like,
to keep the wolves at bay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, takes a breather, and he's writing fucking Desperados Under the Eaves.
Yeah.
One of the great live records, maybe the great live record as far as I'm concerned. Will we assign all of our subjects a very objective, precise rating, star rating, 1 to 3 stars at the end of all of our episodes? That's all. No half scores or anything. You just got to do 1, 2, or 3, like the Michelin guide. How many stars for Stand in the Fire?
3. Come on. Is there going to be anything less would be a disgrace.
That's right. 3 stars. Stand in the Fire. Evan?
I will also give it 3.
Thank you.
But, you know, because what am I going to do? Give it 2? I'll give it 3 this time.
3 stars and a little plate of beef chow mein.
Yes,
for,
absolutely.
Warren Stand in the Fire.
You can't do half stars, but you can add like
like emojis, basically.
You can add an emoji.
I'm gonna give it 3 stars and a little crucifix on which Barabbas the Good Thief was let off of.
three stars and a gun.
Well said.
Yeah.
Thank you, Will, so much for joining us. Do you have any plugs for our wonderful listeners out in
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, Chapo Trap House, the podcast. Check us out on Patreon. But of note to you guys and your listeners, we will be in LA performing at the theater at the Ace Hotel on October 8th. Mm. Tickets are available at chapotraphouse.com/live. And if both you gentlemen are in L.A., I'd love to put you on the list for the show. So we'll be in L.A. next month. Please come out and Hooray. See us perform at the theater at the Ace Hotel. Once again, tickets available at chapotraphouse.com/live.
Will Menaker, Chapo Trap House, you know the pod. Subscribe. Check him out on tour, folks. Thank you so much for joining.
Joker Men.
She tells him she thinks she needs to be free. He tells her he doesn't understand. She takes his hand. She tells him nothing's working out the way they plan. And she's so mad he went on. He can't find the one who was his friend. So he's hanging on to half a heart. He can't have the restless part. So he tells her to hasten down the wind. Perry, turn up the house lights. I found the ones who were my friends. Agrees, he thinks she needs to be free. Then she says she'd rather be with him. And it's just a whim by which she hopes to keep him on the limb. She's so many women that he can't find the one who was his friend. So he's hanging on to half a heart. He can't have the restless part. So he tells her to hasten down the wind. Tells her to hasten down the
Thank you very much.
Keep on rocking. And take my love. And vaya con Dios.